From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. It's been a while, Tony, and maybe you could help catch us up, because that whole region has been busy with just all kinds of changes and all kinds of activity, elections, and...
There's a great deal to catch up on, but I think we can do it quite quickly, and... If we go through the region in terms of elections, for example, Peru had its legislative elections in January that were called after, people may remember that there was a constitutional crisis in Peru with a conflict between the executive and the legislature, and that was resolved in favor of the executive, in favor of President Vizcarra. There were elections held in January, and very inconclusive. And the situation in Peru and is effectively that the country is treading water in terms of its policies and its economy and so forth. And it's still subject to the corruption processes that are going through the courts that are affecting political leaders like Keiko Fujimori and others. And so the election practically changed nothing, although it was a setback. If it did have a clear outcome, it was a setback for the right-wing party of Keiko Fujimori.
I think the last time we discussed this, it was something like two or three of the last three or four presidents of Peru were either in prison had been in prison since their term.
and that remains the same, very little change. And the corruption motif has had very strong effects in Peru in favor of a center-right consensus. And that's essentially the situation in Peru.
Right.
And of course, at grassroots, there are protest movements among indigenous people against environmental projects and so on, but essentially there's very little change in Peru's situation since last year. And in Bolivia, just south of Peru, the Cucamonga government there, it continues to engage in its process of internal repression, attempting to stifle any chance of a fair outcome to the electoral process that's currently underway. And this, of course, is in the context of yet more reports confirming that Evo Morales won the previous elections held back whenever it was, in early October, I think it was, last year. He won the elections perfectly legitimately, and that's been confirmed time after time in separate independent reports. So, it's just... And perhaps we can talk about the broader context and the role of the United States later, but essentially in Bolivia what they're trying to do is make it impossible for Evo Morales' MAS party to campaign in a free and fair way. There are all kinds of minor policy decisions that make it very difficult for Evo Morales and his team to engage in a successful campaign, despite which opinion polls show that they are the leading party in terms of electoral support at the moment. So
this is the same as in Brazil.
It's not. Sorry, Don.
It's the same as in Brazil. Essentially a set of accusations that are used to remove the government from office. And as time passes, those accusations are shown to have been proven false, but the case against allowing the people removed or the party in which those people participated become involved again in politics, it becomes harder and harder, and a stronger and stronger oppression against that is placed against it. So you have a situation again in Brazil where the most popular politician in the country was not allowed to run for president under false charges of corruption that are proven untrue after the election, and they're using the same model with Evo Morales now.
Yeah, in Morales' case, they're even trying to prevent him from running as a candidate for the Senate now in Bolivia. Right. It's not even clear, given the current pandemic and the political response to the pandemic, it's not even clear that the elections are going to be held as scheduled in May.
At all.
And right. At all. So let's see what's going to happen with that. A slightly different twist to the electoral theme in South America have been the recent elections in Guyana. Guyana is a key country in terms of support for US policies in CARICOM, because David Granger, the former president, was very much a supporter of US policy in the region and very much a supporter of US policy against Venezuela, for example. However, I've forgotten how long ago it was. I think it was about 18 months ago now. The opposition in Parliament managed to get a vote of no confidence through against David Granger, and he then stonewalled, completely betraying his responsibility under the terms of Guyana's constitution, refused to hold new elections, and it was only as a result of negotiations between the opposition and the Granger government, with the help of CARICOM, the Caribbean community, that led to an agreement to hold elections, which were held, I think, in late February.
Yeah.
But there's still no result. There's a lot of argument in Guyana itself about whether the vote was free and fair. The whole process ended up in Guyana's Supreme Court. There's a recount. CARICOM is taking part in organizing oversight of the recount, but it's still not clear what's going to happen, and it may well turn out that there'll be a prolonged political crisis in Guyana over the results of those extremely flawed elections, because obviously what happened is that David Granger's party didn't read the vote, because they were losing, and that's why there's been no results so far. But anyway, we'll see what happens there in Guyana. And also crisis in Haiti, that crisis continues there. The government has, it's de facto government in reality, because it has zero popular support, and there are protests in the streets, by different sectors, by teachers, by doctors, by even the police have engaged in protests against their own government. So it's not clear how that crisis is going to resolve in Haiti. But again, and what we're seeing is the continuation of, just as in Peru, very little change from what happened in Peru's overall situation over the last year, there's also been very little change in that sense in the situation in Haiti. It just continues lurching from one crisis to another with a government that represents nobody, it's incapable of resolving the crisis. So that, again, we'll just have to see what happens in Haiti over the next few months.
Right.
And in Ecuador, as a result of the, yeah, and people may remember that Lenin Moreno had to back down in very short order when he was faced with popular protest last year over his attempts to impose an austerity package after negotiations with the International Monetary Fund. Well, and as a result of the current crisis, he's been able to declare a state of national emergency, and he's sneaking in an austerity package under the terms of that national emergency. It remains to be seen how people in Ecuador are going to react to that. I should imagine that they'll react very badly, and it'll be another crisis for Lenin Moreno. And I think that's, in a way, that's a theme that is a constant across the region. All these right-wing governments, like Lenin Moreno, like David Grange in Guyana, like the coup mongers in Bolivia, like the, in to a lesser extent, the centre-right government in Peru, the government in Chile, Piñera, has just declared a national emergency, which is very convenient for him because it means that he can, with some kind of constitutional legitimacy, continue to deploy the police and the army to repress the protests that were calling for his resignation. I mean, that's very clear now that the protests in Chile are now very, very clearly calling for the resignation of Sebastián Piñera. And there in Chile, it remains to be seen in the same way that it's not clear what's going to happen to the elections in Bolivia. It's not clear what's going to happen to the process for the referendum on a constituent assembly in Chile, which would reform Chile's constitution. It's not clear what's going to happen to that now as a result of the pandemic crisis with the COVID-19 virus.
Right, right.
So this is a theme that you can see that all these right-wing governments that have broken down, for them, in a way, the pandemic crisis is a huge relief because they can deploy with constitutional justification their police and their army to control the situation in the country that's in crisis as a result of the virus pandemic. But when you contrast that with Argentina, for example, it's interesting to look at the difference between Argentina and Brazil, for example, and the way they dealt with the crisis. In Brazil, Bolsonaro is pretending that there's nothing to worry about and it's all a big exaggeration and he still hasn't developed his approach to the crisis in the way that Donald Trump did. I mean, he continues to come out with these ridiculous statements and engage in completely inappropriate behavior, breaking every kind of protocol and convention that have been recommended by the Organization of Pan-American Health or the World Health Organization. Whereas in Argentina, you've got a situation where the country it's opted for the suppression model of dealing with the viral pandemic. And at the same time, it's engaging in social measures that are designed to mitigate the worst effects of that on people at grassroots. And that's in such sharp contrast to what's happening in Brazil, where it'll be interesting to see over the next month or so how the virus pandemic develops in those two countries, because they're taking such different approaches. So there, in Colombia too, and Iván Duque, if it weren't for the pandemic crisis, the headlines would be how he's trying to fend off judicial processes involving corruption allegations, linking him to corruption by former President Álvaro Uribe.
Right.
And there too in Colombia. And that's going through the Colombian courts at the moment. But the headline, it's dropped out of the headlines because of the crisis about the pandemic. And also in Colombia, the human rights crisis there. And it's possible that human rights crisis, once the pandemic dies out as the crisis because of the COVID-19 virus dies down. Mm-hmm. It's possible that the human rights crisis in Colombia, along with the corruption allegations, will bring the political crisis in Colombia to a head this year, because what are we 2.5 months into the year, and there have been something like 50 social and community leaders murdered, and I think the total now is 18 former members of the FARC who opted for the peace process who've been murdered. Now, if that had happened in Venezuela, And we've mentioned this before, and we've made this point many times. If the human rights violations that happen in Colombia were to happen in Venezuela, and there'd be calls for immediate intervention.
Oh, please.
Again, the situation in Colombia is that a right-wing government in crisis is able to kind of ride it out for the moment as a result of the global pandemic that's affecting the whole world, and it's affecting Latin America in a very serious way as well.
Yeah, right.
So, I don't know if you want to talk more about how the region is dealing with the virus pandemic itself. Is that something that we should talk about?
Yeah, somewhat. We had a sample of. It's so interesting how many balls are up in the air at the same time, and which ones manage to get tossed back up in the air. Which ones fall down onto the stage floor, or fly off into the audience? you have sort of it's a very real discussion on its own terms, but also a symbolic discussion in the elections in the United States over the question of socialism, quote unquote. Bernie Sanders, who is perhaps an FDR-style Democrat at the very most, both styles himself and is slandered, that's the intent, as a socialist in the media year. It has had an interesting effect in that some supporters said, yes, he is a socialist, that's why we like him, and made the word socialism and some of the concepts of socialism rehabilitated in the United States in politics. They had been really not permitted since the days of Joe McCarthy back in the early 1950s and the beginning of the Cold War. When all of that started playing out, the issue they decided to choose as a defining distinction between the socialists and the not-socialists, the true Americans, quote-unquote, the supporters of capitalism, was health care. That Sanders' symbolic socialism meant Medicare for all, which means a good chunk of your medical bills would be paid by the state if you got sick. That's essentially that's the extent of that socialism. But Medicare for all,
right,
and a reorganization of the financing of healthcare in the United States along more public lines, in any event, more publicly regulated lines. And a rejection of that, both by Trump in terms of rhetoric and Biden in terms of ideological rhetoric, in terms of terminology and also policy, that's not the solution. At the time that happens, and we have this outbreak of this thing, China attacks it aggressively, and they build a hospital in, what was that, in 10 days or something, and some other massive mobilization of public resources to fight this, and it appears that this has been tremendously successful. I mean, we don't know yet, but it seems so. So you kind of have that whirling around. At the same time that there's this battle going on between the left and right in Latin America that seems to have come around with popular, among the popular part of the political movements in these countries, with the left, coming back into favor, if they were ever out of favor, but getting the upper hand, to be met immediately with reaction, military coups, and other retrenchment activity, backed and financed and encouraged by the United States. That suddenly this been a very active right-wing resurgence, primarily extra-legal through the military and like that.
Exactly.
So, and so the popular sentiment flowing one way and governments being imposed, in essence, from the other. This is, you know, a condition where you're saying basically that the people will not allow themselves to be governed in the old ways, and they choose a new way, and the government will not allow the people to be ruled in the old ways because they cannot govern them that way, which means, you know, through fake elections or whatever, but rather through direct... So this is a pre-revolutionary condition that's shaping up at the same time that you have essentially a global economic collapse starting to shake out. Both in terms of finance capital because of structural problems, obviously, you know, and inclination that way because of the actual economic conditions, but also the serious manipulation of the markets and such with the intent to, you know, to gain political advantage. There was an acknowledgement by, after, you know, months of... you know, a dozen or so Democratic Party presidential candidates in the United States, for example, an acknowledgement about 3 or 4 weeks ago that Donald Trump was likely going to win the election absent an economic catastrophe in the United States, and that the only thing that might head this off would be if Sanders were to be the Democratic nominee. And it appears that the elite here would like to see anything but that, including... an economic catastrophe. And so you saw, this was the most telling thing to me, after the first couple rattles in the markets, when they had it was about 2.5 weeks ago, two successive drops, you know, huge drops in value in the market indices, suddenly a resurgence in the on the third day or the fourth day. And the comments from the Democratic minority leader in the Senate, from Chuck Schumer, who was actually owned by Wall Street. I mean, he is essentially Wall Street's senator. And so when he said this, you know that he's saying it, you know, on behalf of Wall Street, you know, in concert with the instructions of Wall Street, not in opposition to them, that he was saying things that essentially were intended to try to sink the markets because of the political benefits that would give in taking Trump out as president. So, in other words, you had, at the very time that the markets are reacting as if they're afraid of the future because of the uncertainty in the future and uncertainty around Trump, for example, and his role of, you know, protecting humanity's, you know, genetic code or whatever from the virus, that you saw an attempt across the media and across the political establishment to utilize this to create instability in the markets, directed essentially by Wall Street in order to achieve a particular goal, which all by itself has to induce, you know, some sort of fear and uncertainty among investors who are not so inclined to play this game. And then as they start rolling out the response for the, you know, for the medical crisis, that one of the first things that they're doing is a dictatorial approach to economic adjustments. It's unprecedented, perhaps, in scale in human history. They closed all the restaurants in the United States, in essence, by decree.
From an American point of view, and that it makes no difference who's the president because U.S. foreign policy is going to change hardly at all.
Right,
whoever's
that's true.
Whoever's the president.
Yep.
But that economic point that you're making is very, very important for Latin America, partly because so many countries still have the United States as their main trading partner.
Well, literally, they've always said, if the United States sneezes, we catch pneumonia. I mean, you know, and so literally we're looking at that now.
In particular here in Central America, Don, one of the big worries is with all those people that live off tips in the service industries, in the United States. And a big chunk of, a huge proportion of those are people from, the Hispanic people from Central America and other parts of Latin America.
Right.
And that's going to very seriously affect the family remittances that those people will be sending back to their families back in Latin America, especially Central America. And so, and the double hit that Latin America is going to take is a drop in their ability to market their exports to the United States market, but right. also a drop in the very important income that right. reaches people at grassroots throughout.
Right. You know, look, I mean, here's the architecture of some of that here. You have people that, work in these jobs here, okay? And then they either have bought buildings for themselves, you know, so they have 3, 4, 5 apartments or whatever. They have mortgages that they pay on. Some are in tenants to groups of landlords that have, you know, built up a real estate portfolio servicing people in exactly this position. The rug comes out from under all of that all of a sudden. You're going to start to see foreclosures. You're going to start to see not just a slowdown in the funds that go out of the country to people in Ecuador and, you know, Nicaragua and wherever else down there, but actually a shift in the direction of funds, because the folks here are going to start losing their assets in the midst of that. And those lenders that were willing to lend before are going to start getting wiped out. So it's up the whole, right. like the whole apparatus is at risk.
Yeah, and here, and one of the things that's pending on March the 20th that may or may not be affected by the crisis in the United States is the election for the OAS General Secretary, which yeah. is, in some ways, it's a very important election, in some ways it's not. But if a relatively progressive candidate like the Ecuadorian former foreign minister, Maria Espinosa, who is also a former president of the General Assembly at the United Nations, she's running against the U.S. puppet, Luis Almagro. And it looks as though it's going to be a kind of 50-50 election, very almost too close to call. I may be wrong about that, but I've looked at the breakdown, and it's very probable that the great majority of CARICOM countries are going to support Espinosa, along with Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, of course, and Mexico, too, and Argentina.
Right.
So the crisis in the United States, in a kind of strange way, may shift opinion within that OAS election process, and with any luck, Luis Almagro will not get re-elected. And if it weren't for all this uncertainty that's developed around the pandemic crisis, he would almost certainly get re-elected as things stand.
Right.
But with the crisis and with all the uncertainty about the what is the United States going to look like in 3 or 4 months' time, you know, and that kind of uncertainty renders the election a slightly more uncertain than it might otherwise have been. And I do think that Espinosa does stand a chance, which would be a tremendous boost for countries like, in particular, Venezuela,
right.
of course, which is facing a very intense and intensifying war
right.
On the part of the United States and its European allies, because the United States and its allies are refusing to offer Venezuela any relief from the sanctions, even despite the cost in humanitarian terms that's going to have on Venezuela's ability to address the pandemic crisis.
Right, to the contrary, as a matter of fact.
You know,
what they've been doing instead, rather, has been to try to tighten the sanctions further, and to do that everywhere that they could to take advantage of this crisis. We're out of time. We're going to have to come back to this next week, and I really appreciate your coming in and speaking with us today, and welcome back.
Yeah, you're very welcome, John. Good to be back. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Thank you, yes.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.